is Steve Maltz at Tower Hill. This is the start of what used to be my walking tour, Jewish London. I used to take anyone from tourists to school parties, synagogues, churches, film crews, radio crews. In fact, took Julia Fisher around once and she won an award for it. So I'm hoping that I'm going to remember everything that I used to say and do and go to. But I haven't done it for 2 years, so this is going to be fun. So I think I'm ready to sort of walk off now. I'm walking now into the square mile. Not the square mile of the city, which is next to it, which is probably the richest square mile in the country, but instead I'm going to the poorest square mile in the country, or at least it was 100 years ago when Jewish immigrants came over, driven out of Poland, Russia, Eastern Europe through the pogroms, came for a safe refuge in London. Around about 100,000 of them would have come over at that time. Amongst them would have been my four great-grandparents who came over from Poland, Lithuania, Latvia and Russia. So this is my story, this is my family story. I hope you carry on with me on this journey and that we have some a bit of fun together. Okay, off we go. Oh, the wind is forcing me away now. Hello again. Hi. I've now wandered down a road called Crutched Friars, standing outside a wine bar called the Habit. The story being that here in the corner there used to be a friary. The whole area used to be a friary. And at the corner is wine bar, two sort of stone statues of a couple of friars. The only link to history, the word crutched friars is an old English term meaning crossed friars. So these are friars that went around with crosses on them. So I suppose they were also crusaders. We won't talk about that. Okay, I'm following on the Roman wall, the wall that used to surround the old city of London. And the street that's facing me is called Drury Street, which ought to ring a bell. Drury Street. Which makes me think back to the Jews. When did they first come over? Well, they came over William the Conqueror, 1066. Someone had to keep the books. Yeah, things haven't changed. Unfortunately, not for the right reasons. Jews were not allowed to hold office or to hold land or to do anything that civilized Christian society was allowed to do. So all they were allowed to do was lend money or to be doctors. Now, because of the money side of it, they were brought over as financiers by the French when the conquerors came. And the place where they stayed in London was just off Cheapside near St Paul's, and it was called Old Drury. And they stayed there from 1066 for a couple of hundred years. It wasn't an easy time. They were looked on as aliens, not dealt with very fairly by the nobles who distrusted them because they were getting rich, by the peasants who thought they were devils. So things started going really wrong from, I think, 1190 onwards, when Richard the Lionheart was crowned King of England at Westminster Abbey. The Jews at that time, you know, were quite fairly established and in their own way confident of their standing. Misplaced, of course, because they wanted to come to the coronation ceremony at Westminster Abbey. They were told not to come. They came anyway, and the king and others just were frightened of them and felt that they were coming to bring some sort of curse. So the Jews were just chased through the streets, and you know, I can't remember how many were killed, but I know a lot ended up in the Tower of London just for safety, and also know that started off a wave of pogroms that swept the country. The most famous one being in York, when the Jews ended up in the place called Clifford Tower, where I believe they committed suicide, and the place was burnt down, and hundreds were killed. And this happened in different ways in many towns across England. And the culmination of all this was in 1290. The king of the time, Edward I, decided that he didn't need Jewish money anymore. The Italians were doing quite well, and the Lombards were bringing their talents to the table. So let's kick the Jews out. So there weren't many Jews left. I think a couple of thousand. They were virtually stripped of everything. You know, so many laws had been passed to marginalise them that they probably did them a favour. But they stuck them into boats on the Thames. Off they went. 1290. Between then and between the time that they did come back, there were no Jews in England. And I'll mention that at my next stop. I hope you heard all this okay. Speak to you soon. Hi. You can hear the atmospheric effects here. The bells. I'm standing outside St. Botolph's Aldgate. In front of me is the great big tower of the church, going back to the 18th century. Behind that, a crane, a massive crane that towers over it. Interesting, the crane has got the logo on it, St. Botolph's as well. Behind me is it's known as the Gherkin, which is another monstrosity, modern monstrosity. And also behind me, I can't see it because it's not there anymore, is the old gate of the city. Aldgate, because that is where I am, Aldgate. From Aldgate is where Geoffrey Chaucer, who was the tax man at the time, used to sit in his rooms over the top of the gate, looking down at the pilgrims coming in and out of the city. And from there he wrote his stories, The Miller's Tale, and all the others I can't think of, the Canterbury Tales. From here, Daniel Defoe was married in this church. Isaac Newton lived just above the Pret a Manger over there. Don't think he's there anymore, of course. Stupid joke. More bells. I'm looking into the church itself, St. Botolph's. It's an interesting church. In the garden is a sort of metallic sculpture called Sanctuary. I believe it's done by someone, a lady called, I think, Naomi Blake, and she was a Holocaust survivor. And Sanctuary is sort of a man with his back against the wall, and the wall is sort of stretched behind him, and then sort of covers him as well. And it's the idea of sort of safety, you know, and it's very poignant considering, you know, this came out of the Holocaust. This church, St. Botolph's, was always a friend of the Jews at the time when the Jews needed a friend, in, you know, 100 years ago. It's also friends of the prostitutes at the time of Jack the Ripper. It's friends of the homeless. You'll see many of them there, and also friends of the homosexual population. And I believe it's very active on that front at the moment, which is why I'm not going in there. More bells, which probably means you can't hear me anyway, so I'm going to move on from here. Okay, bye. Hi. A little bit of wind here. Not for me, but from the atmosphere. Anyway, I've sort of leaving the city area, moving west towards the East End. Now sort of on the border. First, a bit of history. If you remember, we said earlier that the Jews were kicked out 1290 by Edward I. They were to go for an awful long time. Interestingly, in that period when they were not meant to be here, Shakespeare was writing his plays, and of course we had the Merchant of Venice with Shylock, a Jewish character, and you just wonder who he based that character on. And probably it was on Jews who were here but not here. There were secret Jews called Marinos, which is, I think, the Portuguese word or Spanish word for pig, which obviously wasn't a name they gave themselves. What happened was a lot of Jews had come from, say, Spain and Portugal and lived through the Inquisition, and they decided, for intents and purposes, to live as Christians, or outwardly as Christians. but inwardly as Jews. And a lot of them became sort of rich merchants and came over to London and set up shop. And one of them was quite famous. He was the physician, I can't remember his name now, physician to Queen Elizabeth I. Unfortunately, he was accused of poisoning her, which was a lie, but he was executed. There were quite a few other families living in secret in the city, and which brings us to the 17th century and to Oliver Cromwell. Now, Oliver Cromwell, the Lord Protector, he was running the country in between the two Charleses, and he was an interesting man. Towards the end of his life, he was a Puritan, and Puritans, you know, were strong Christians, very much an Old Testament style, and because of that, they were very positive, interesting, towards the Jewish people, in the sense, in a prophetic sense, in that, you know, the Jews were needed in this country in order to hasten the coming back of Jesus. So it was all sort of eschatological, to coin a phrase. But anyway, the situation was with Oliver Cromwell was that he was at war with Spain, and he looked over there and he saw there were a group of people who were able to move between countries quite freely. We're not sort of bound to the country, but you know, because of, well, these were the Jewish people, basically. The Jews were the merchants. They, you know, the Rothschilds were coming up. I'm not sure they were around at that time, but plenty of Jewish families were moving between countries quite freely, engaged in sort of foreign exchange and lending and all that stuff. And Cromwell thought to himself, there's the religious aspect of bringing the Jews back to our country, but there's also the fact that they would make very good spies. You know, bring them over here, get them to pledge your loyalty, and then send them over to Spain and other countries and get them to spy for us. So he had his reasons for bringing them over. So he summoned one of the rabbis of probably the biggest Jewish community at that time in the continent, which was at Amsterdam, where there was quite a sizable Spanish and Portuguese community of Jews. And he summoned over this rabbi, whose name totally escapes me, which just shows you 2 years of not doing this. Some things had to suffer, so you can look that one up. It may even come to me in a minute. Anyway, summoned this Jew over, and he sort of summoned together the good and the great and the good of the land, the nobles, and they all sat together at a meeting, and this rabbi had to defend himself or defend the need for Jews to come over to England. And he had to answer three questions. First one was, if the Jews came over, would they keep themselves and not try to convert the Christians? No problem. You know, we don't believe in proselytizing and anything like that, so that was okay, a tick. Second question was, if the Jews came over, would they refrain from killing Christian kids and using their blood for Passover, for creating the matzahs, which was known as the blood libel, which was a complete fabrication and the lie, but nevertheless, they asked this question, thinking there was some truth in it. Of course, the rabbi said, "No, of course we won't. You know, we like Christians, but not necessarily to eat them or to cut their throats." Yeah. Anyway, that was a bit bad taste. Anyway, there's a third reason. I just can't remember what the third one was. Would they, if not lend money at an exorbitant rate? And he agreed to that as well. So anyway, everything was going well, but he went back to Amsterdam, and meanwhile they deliberated and decided not to invite the Jews back. Cromwell wasn't very pleased with this, and I think called another council, and again he didn't get anywhere. And then events took over, and the event was a fully blown war with Spain. And when wars happen, of course, those of a Spanish persuasion living in London suddenly found themselves being arrested, found their, you know, houses been taken away from them, and whatever. Now, if you remember just a few minutes ago, I mentioned there were some Jews living in this country, ostensibly Spanish, and they were the Marinos, the secret Jews, and living as Christians. And they looked at the situation and thought, wait a minute, let's come out of the closet. We're not Spanish. We don't want our goods seized. We're Jewish. So they all suddenly declared their Jewishness, because they knew about these council meetings. They knew about the Cromwell, and they just took their chance. Also, as a result of the Cromwell meetings, it was declared that the expulsion in 1290 wasn't even legally binding. So they felt they were on strong ground, and they declared themselves as Jews. And it went okay. They were given their own burial ground and their own synagogue. And I'm standing outside the first synagogue of the resettlement. It's now a bank. Where are we? In Creechurch Lane, at the border of the city, the east of London. The site of the first synagogue after the resettlement, 1657 to 1701. Spanish and Portuguese Jews congregation. And Jews came over from Amsterdam at that time, and these were the Spanish and Portuguese Jews. So we now begin the story of the resettlement, and that's all I'm going to say for now. Bye. Hello. It's crazy bells. Hopefully they're not putting you off too much. Okay, Duke's Place, just round the corner from that synagogue that's now a bank. Okay, just continuing the story. It wasn't just the Spanish and Portuguese Jews that came over at that time of Cromwell. There were other Jews in Europe through the diaspora, and the Spanish and the Portuguese were the Sephardi Jews, you know, obviously those from Spanish origin, but they were also the Ashkenazis, who were more sort of Eastern European, German, Dutch, and they came over too, and they had their synagogue. And I'm standing outside the remains of it. In fact, there is no remains, just a plaque on the wall. But this was the major synagogue at that time. It's called the Great Synagogue, Duke's Place. It was like the St. Paul's of Judaism at that time, or Jewry. It was the, you know, any time there had to be any civic sort of ceremony or anything, this is where it took place. This is where ultimately the chief rabbi would come from. It's very much the establishment synagogue. It stood here from 1690 until 1941, where it was destroyed during the Second World War. I've got some pictures of it somewhere, and my mum and dad have very vague memories of coming here, but it's way before my time. Yeah, it was interesting, as I say, once the Jews had become the establishment, which was, you know, approaching the 18th, 19th century, where there were Jewish families that who rose to prominence, and you know, we got a lot of say prime ministers, financiers, real sort of people of quality came out of this. But this would have been their synagogue. The chief rabbi, I'm trying to think of their name. I think, oh my goodness me, Nathan Adler. That was it. Rabbi Nathan Adler was the rabbi of Hamburg, and one day Queen Victoria came over heavily pregnant on a state visit to the German nobility, and she started going into labour, which was constitutionally, this was a disaster, because there's no way that her son or daughter could have been born on German soil. At the time, she was visiting Nathan Adler, who was the rabbi of Hamburg, and he suggested, why don't you get into your boat, back into your boat, and just sail, you know, 100 yards or whatever, just as far as you need, just to be away from German soil and give birth there. Seems like an obvious piece of advice. She did that, gave birth, and remembered him. So when there was a vacancy in this synagogue here, and in as much as, you know, the Queen of England was able to sort of put her oar in, she suggested Nathan Adler for the job. So he came over and became one of the great ones, one of the great rabbis of this congregation. And that was in the obviously mid-19th century. So I'm going to leave the Ashkenazis and go back to the Sephardis now, which would be my next stop. Hello. Interestingly, my next border call was going to be another synagogue, Sephardi synagogue called Bevis Marks, which is when the Jewish community at that time outgrew this small synagogue, which was basically above a pub, I believe, at the time. They had a purpose-built synagogue, which was built in 1701, and amazingly is still intact, with some of the original furniture still there and still functional and operational. And that's where I was going to go first. I walked in there, noticed there was no one there except the shamash, the man in charge. And this was the shamash who unfortunately sort of inadvertently fell out with many years ago, and I thought he'd moved on, but he's back there now. And problem was, he sort of accused me of evangelising, which was untrue, because I never do that on these tours. I have to be very sensitive, and but I made things worse by one day in the aftermath of 9/11. I accidentally left behind a rucksack in there, and when I came back, the police had been the sniffer dogs, and they weren't very happy with me. So that's my history. I tried to come back there a bit later, but in the meantime, we're now approaching the East End. I'm at the borders of the city in the East End, looking straight at Petticoat Lane Market, which is a market that's been around for centuries. It used to be, the road used to be called Hogs Lane. It used to be, used to buy and sell pig there, I imagine. And then 19th century, largely taken over by Jews, selling mainly clothing and textiles. It's hence the name Petticoat Lane, which is, even though it's now called Middlesex Street, they still keep the old name just for the tourists. As a kid, I used to work there, known as the schlapper, which is someone that worked for my uncle, and I just carried material around for him, loaded and unloaded vans for him. And in fact, he only just retired a couple of years ago. And in fact, when I used to give tours, we used to introduce people to him, and he even got a TV crew came round and interviewed him as well. And that's what made his day. But so this was a very hustling, bustling market, particularly at the time of the Jews. This is where they bought their chickens and their kosher food, and there's a lot of haggling, a lot of excitement and interest and noise and smells and everything you can associate with you know, the Russian immigrants and the East European immigrants. So I'm now going to walk through there. No Jews anymore. I mean, out of 100,000 Jews, there might be just 100 or two left in this area. I might find my cousin-in-law maybe there, but apart from him, I'd be very lucky to find a Jewish face. It'd be mainly Asians, and anyone else, but probably not Jews. So I'm going to walk into Petticoat Lane, now walking into the area called Spitalfields, which was the area, interesting, always an immigrant area. Started off before the Jews, started off the Huguenots, the French Protestants came over, kicked out of Catholic Spain. Jews came over, the Irish, Chinese, Germans, people from all nationalities, and latterly the Bengalis, the Bangladeshis, who now form most of the population of Spitalfields, or they did when I was doing my tours. And I'll find out in a minute whether it is mainly just now a Muslim area. Interestingly, it's been a Christian area, Jewish area, now it's a Muslim area. How times change. Okay, I'll sign off for now. Hi. Interestingly, so going back to the Jews that came over to Duke's Place and Bevis Marks, and they became like the Jewish establishment. Sorry about this wind. For instance, Benjamin Disraeli, he came to the synagogue. His father was a member of Bevis Marks Synagogue, and was refused a bar mitzvah because his dad owed some money and was too stubborn to pay it. So the Israeli's dad took him away from the synagogue and had him baptised instead. And ironically, that enabled him to become Prime Minister of England because he was able to pledge the vow on the Christian Bible, whereas a Jew who hadn't, who'd stayed within Judaism wouldn't have been able to do that. So just amazing how history revolves and things come out of a single decision. At the time when the Jewish establishment, as I say, like the Rothschilds and Montefiore's and the Samuels and all the big families, that in the 19th century they saw, wait a minute, all these Jews were coming over, these poor, deprived, smelly, strange sounding names, Jews, you know, they were coming over from Russia and Eastern Europe with no money, you know, barely the clothes on their back. And the rich Jews already here realised they had to do something about it. And Rothschild was said to have said, we have here a new Poland on the streets of London. First we must humanise them, then we must anglicise them. And that was interesting because they realised that the best way for the Jewish community to survive was to assimilate itself, was to make itself more English, in order to sort of stave away the anti-Semitism of the past. So where I'm standing now, which is around the corner from Sandys Row, is the site of the old Jewish free school where my dad went when he was a youngster. At the time it was the biggest school in Europe. You know, not just the biggest Jewish school, but the biggest school in Europe. Thousands of people, Jewish people there, boys and girls, you know, hundreds of teachers. It was massive. There's not a trace of it now. I imagine it was bombed in the war. It couldn't have been, because my dad must have been knocked down after the war. I know it moved to Camden Town and then somewhere else. But the point of the school is that only English was spoken. Okay, so the kids were coming in speaking Yiddish, Russian, Polish, etc. But they came out of the school as young English gentlemen. And it was good in a way, because it enabled them to progress in life and to move out of the ghettos into ordinary life. And out of these people came some of the major families in this country that so many modern day Jewish celebrities and writers and TV personalities and actors and comedians and businessmen came out of this area. Their families came out of this area, and it's through establishments like the Jewish Free School that they're able to assimilate and flourish. And I'm going to see another such place in my next port of call. Okay, poor Jewish, the Jewish soup kitchen, now a place for posh people to live, bought out by property developer. When the Jews moved out and there were no need for a soup kitchen, though my great aunt Bessie used to get her matzahs from here, I believe, through Passover time. And my dad used to come just before the war, queue up for his family and pick up his bread and his basics. And yeah, this was established in 1902, opened by Herbert Samuel, the MP, through proceeds donated by the rich Jews of the time, the Rothschilds and the others. And it was a lifeline for poor Russian Jews who queued for miles, you know, around the block a few times to get their soup and other basic stuff. As I say, now it's just a shop front, obviously kept there by preservation order, and just a convenient stop for tour guides like myself. It's one of the few remnants of that area that you can actually, you know, show people and talk about and let their imagination do the rest. Opposite, interestingly, is a mural on the wall behind it, which has sort of colourful paintings and pictures, drawings by kids from the local school, which show a lot of Jewish and Yiddish songs and sort of illustrations of Jewish life. And as I said, done by school kids, Jewish school kids, no, Asian school kids, because it's the Asians who are here at the moment. Okay. There's a tour group there, so I can't get any closer. Might try to eavesdrop, but don't promise anything. Okay. I've been joined. I've been joined by Moira, my good friend Moira, who's just appeared. And let us. Why, Moira, why are you here today?
I'm here today because it's an open day to go to Jewish synagogues and places like that, and because I'm very interested in it.
Any particular reason why you're, because you're not Jewish, why do you have this interest in Jewish matters, or is it so far back that you can't remember?
I'm interested because the Lord laid on my heart an interest in Israel and the Jewish roots of my faith, and that just means so much to me. And Jesus is a Jew, was a Jew, is still a Jew, and that is why everything Jewish is so close to my heart.
Great, thanks Moira. And so we'll be off together. We're going to go back to Sandy's Road now, and hopefully I won't mess things up on the recording this time. Started off as a French Huguenot chapel, then a Universalist Baptist church, Scottish Baptist, Salem Chapel, and then the Jews came.
So 1854.
So Jews didn't come for almost 100 years. Mm. And it's been a synagogue ever since. This is Sandy's Road Synagogue. So 2008 restoration, they said they need £500,000 for the roof.
But they are going to do it.
They've had a lottery grant, but I think they need
good.
A bit more than that.
Mm.
Okay.
So you know more than me.
Right. The building has been a religious building for 300 years. Prior to being a synagogue, it was a Huguenot chapel. And in the 1840s, when the settler people coming over across from Europe, Dutch Jews decided that they would effectively form a congregation. And they had services around the corner, and then a group of them had sufficient funds to effectively acquire the property. And in 1854, this opened up after it had been converted from the chapel. Now, originally, the entrance was on that side through Parliament Court, but because we had to face east, everything got converted around, and so the entrance came on that side. And since then, effectively, the community grew to its probably peak at to the turn of the century, into the 20s, etc. And then, of course, it goes the other way. Everything goes the other way. I mean, most Dutch Jews have connections to here. As I said, I'm the mitzvah here. My father was mitzvah here. My grandfather was a member here. So I go back three, possibly four generations. And I'm pleased to say that my son, my younger son, who's studying documentary photography, is also part of the board of management as well, so he's involved as well. So his choice, he wants to do it.
How many members do you have?
We still have 225 members, but most are very elderly. They don't frequent the shul that often. We have a core congregation for Shabbat every 2 weeks. We have mincha services Monday to Thursday, the afternoon services. That's 60 to 70 people from Broadgate in the city. And then this year, for the first time in a long time, we did a Purim service and we managed to attract 80 people, which was wonderful. And for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Simchas Torah, we have invited a chazan who we've engaged, and we're trying to promote that through an advert, through articles, through press, and especially today as well, to let people know what is happening. Mm. To see if we can get people coming for the services.
I suppose because not so many people live in this area now, that's another reason, isn't it?
That's also true, but like everything else, I mean, all religion, everybody has to feel comfortable with what level of religion that they have. For me, especially because we're in the East End, I'm trying to attract a congregation. How they get here is up to them, as long as they come to shul.
Mm.
So I'm not worried about that. I'm a traditionalist.
Yeah.
But it has a lot of history for me. It's the only place that I've come, I come to where I get emotional about. And that's, you know, I've been to Israel several times, and a lot of people feel that when they get there. I don't, but I get it here.
Mm. It's got a lovely, warm feeling.
Yes.
Everybody says that.
Yeah.
And hopefully once we get the building secure and the roof secure, we will start raising funds and get grants, but it's difficult at the moment. I mean, there is a recession. Charities, foundations are having their own problems. There's been an expression where a lot of charities got mad off in America, unfortunately, where they lost a lot of money. But we've also had grants from the Rothschild Foundation. This year we missed out on one because they were already committed to the Jewish Museum, but we've been told we can go back next year. So there are places we can go to, but it just, we all have jobs, businesses, we're all volunteers, so we do it when we can. But in time, if we are looking to raise the sort of money, then we're going to have to get a full-time fundraiser on board. But he has to be paid as well. So unfortunately, in order to preserve what we have, it's about money. That's the way it is. But, you know, we're happy to do it, and there are a lot of people out there who are willing to support us as well. And we hope there'll be many more.
We begin with Gracious, doing our Genesis in the beginning, and we end when Moses dies, right at the end. We read it every year, right through, and in 4 weeks' time, there will be this festival called Simchat Torah, the Rejoicing of the Lord, in which we finish one immediately, we begin the next one.
You start
so you
with
never
which one?
Pardon?
You start with which one?
Oh, they're not five separate. Each one has all the five books. Each one is a complete scroll. They are copied, they're written by a scribe on parchment, and they're written in special ink that's made from vegetable material, I think. And they're now computer checked to see that they're completely accurate, but actually they are copied from generation to generation. One scroll serves as the model for the next scroll to be written.
So each scroll has got the five books?
Each scroll has the five books of Moses. Yeah. And we decorate them, we dress them to cover these binders are called Trees of Life, eight times, and we grasp them when we hold six up. And they're dressed, and then they're decorated in the silverware, which is, we never touch a sacred terror in case we need to erase part of it, so we use something called the yad, a hand, to point at the words as we read it. We read from right to left. This is reminiscent priestly breastplate that's worn in the Ten Commandments. And these are called rimonim, which means pomegranates. Sometimes you see a crown, a keter, tera. These are called rimonim. They're not pomegranates, as you can obviously see, but we call them tera. And they have bells. So as the Sefer Torah is progressed around, people are aware that you can hear it coming, and you stand up, obviously, as it comes towards you. And it's also reminiscent of the priestly garment that had bells at the bottom of it, pomegranate bells at the bottom of it. And so it's all a reference back. The whole layout, I don't know how much all of you know about the symbol, but the whole of it references back to the temple in Jerusalem. But this area is like the Holy of Holies. The curtain is like the veil that stood before the Holy of Holies. The Bima, which is where we read the law from, is the, and we say our prayers from there in Orthodox synagogues. Some synagogues are laid out differently, but that is reminiscent of the altar that stood in temple times. And so it all references back historically for us through thousands of years. If you have any questions, I'd have to ask them, but I can't. I'm not actually a professional guide.
You're doing very well.
And we always face east. Most synagogues are finding the face east, which is why this was reoriented to face east that way. And this is the traditional focus of a synagogue, the ark, how it's in the scroll.
Before,
in
which direction was it before?
Pardon?
Before, in what direction before you facing the east?
We always face east to East Jerusalem.
Before
it was the Muslims, actually, face east. And if you're in the other hemisphere, you face the other way.
Yeah. Right, we're in Christchurch, Spitalfields Church, and in the foyer are a set of 10 stone tablets that were given to the churches to safeguard them from the original Jewish Christian Mission Society, which was the London Society for the Propagation of the Gospel to the Jews, which is now called CMJ, the Church's Ministry to the Jewish People. When they were moved from their premises in Bethnal Green back in the 19th century, they had these 10 tablets which were given to this church and kept in the crypt until about 3 years ago, and now they've been cleaned up and they're up in the foyer, and they're just commemorating these sort of giants of the old Jewish Christian movement, such as the Reverend Ewald, that's not very interesting. Okay, the Reverend John Christian Reichart. This tablet is erected by a number of Hebrew Christians in affectionate remembrance of his 50 years unwearied efforts for the spiritual welfare of Israel. That's one. William Wynne Wilson, for more than 40 years, sought the welfare of God's ancient people. George Thomas King, a warm and zealous friend to the Society for Promoting Christianity Among the Jews. My heart's design prayer for Israel is that they may be saved. Miss Jane Cook. Incredible, isn't it? Lewis Wayne, now he was famous, he's actually in the history books, whose unwearied journeys at home and abroad laid the foundation for missionary exertions among God's ancient people, whose expositions of the Word of God awakened the Church of Christ to a sense of her interest in the conversion and restoration of the Jews. Reverend Alexandra McCall, former missionary to the Jews. This tablet is erected in affectionate remembrance of the great services he was enabled under God to render to the Church of Christ in general, and to the Jewish nation in particular, by a body of Christian Israelites who long knew and revered the nobleness of his Christian character. And it goes on. Charles Sleech Hawtrey. Charles Hawtrey. Wait a minute. Charles Hawtrey. Carry on, Phil. He was the gay one. I think it's maybe a different one. Maybe one of his far-off ancestors. Certainly no carry-on connection here. His faith and practice as a Christian minister, his knowledge of the Holy Scriptures, his love for the Jewish people, and his unwearied zeal in proclaiming the redeeming love of God in Christ Jesus. And Reverend James Boardman Cartwright. So these are 10 sort of giants of the founding movement, because it all started in London, the evangelizing the Jews. You know, they all started in the Messianic Testimony started in London. We're going to see their old place as well, isn't it?
Reverend Lewis Wayne was mentioned in the Destiny of Britain film.
Ah,
he played
right.
quite a role. I can't remember now.
I think he put the money up, I think, for the start of the missionary work. Born 1772. So most of this work was in like the 19th century. It was a time when the British nation were quite pro-Jewish. You know, for Queen Victoria loved the Jews. Disraeli was Prime Minister. Lord Shaftesbury, William Wilberforce, all those were all pro-Jewish. You know. Of course, that's all changed. Isn't it? The Fournier Street. This is a very interesting building. 1743. It was a Huguenot chapel. The Huguenots were the French Protestants. Then it became London Jew Society, then a Methodist chapel, then a synagogue, and now it's a mosque since the 60s. Yep, I can see you're impressed. during the war, and it was very ultra-orthodox. It's called the Masque Hadass. And ordinary Jews weren't really allowed in there because it was just too holy for them. But they were allowed in the basement, the wine cellar, where they used to hide from the air raids. My mum used to go down there with her brothers and during the air raids and just sort of smell the wine down there and be safe from the bombs. But they weren't allowed in the main building. It's just far too holy. And it's... one interesting point, 1743, it was founded with the motto Umbra Sumus, which means Latin for we're all shadows. And on the deeds of the building it said it must always be for religious use, if they only knew what it would end up as in a Muslim area. But there you go. Outside Fieldgate Street, Great Synagogue, the most incredible living fossil of the bygone ages. Unfortunately, this synagogue's now closed, but it's just open on special days. But it's built next door to one of the biggest mosques in the country. Obviously, the synagogue came first. On one side of it, separated by about 6 inches, is the Great Whitechapel Mosque. On the other side of it is the London Muslim Centre. It's just incredible. You have to be here to see it. But it's like Israel. Imagine, you know, Israel, tiny nation, size of Wales, surrounded by umpteen Muslim countries all bent on killing them. But I'm not saying the Muslims around here are the same, but you know, you can sort of see the connection. Such a Muslim area you will not see, except today. We see a few Jewish faces. You would not see a face that is not Muslim. But now they've opened the synagogue and we're about to go in. So we'll hopefully we'll speak to someone when we get in there.
You
closed down.
Oh yes, we open once a month. It's our new committee decided to open once a month. Now the face, as my daughter would say, does this face look bothered? You upset me. No, when people say you're closed out, I say no. We're like the windmill. We never close. No, we open once a month. The next time they're open is Yom Tov. So, but otherwise, we always find out from the office when they're open. I can't remember exactly when. It would have worked out, I think, the 15th, but it's about a week before Yom Tov. It's not worth it, so they'll open Yom Tov.
Do you open up for school parties?
Yes, yes. We take them round. They come in, the kids, and they look and they go, wow, that's good, lovely. And you know, but they're very good, the children, and you know, we bring it down to their level. And that says, do you know, you've all got a telephone director card. So he takes out his mobile, says, not this one, and not the one you've got at home, it's this one. Put your hand out, make a fist, like that, like that. Hello, God, this is me. And they get so involved, you know. You've got to, especially some of them as young as 7 years old. You know, so we may try and make it look a bit of fun. And he says, how many of you would like to come and spend the Sabbath with me? The hands go up quick. So he turns around and says, you know what? You can't watch telly. You can't write. You can't play football. You can't go to McDonald's. The face is dropped. Then afterwards he says to me, how many of you would still like to come? Some of them still do, but we try and make it a bit of fun and you know, and tell them about it. And he says, you know, who goes to a mosque, who goes to a church, and what's the difference? And, you know, but and some of them ask what various things are. And they say, what's up there?
Hello. This is your husband, isn't it?
This is the husband.
I've been here a few times.
Once seen, never forgotten.
I always remember you for your passion.
Your passion, Jewish passion. Yeah.
So you're not the caretaker then?
No, I'm the only life vice president, and once a year I get down here to do this job.
Hello, young man. You're going to come and join us.
I love every minute. I love every minute of it.
I'll tell you what,
say,
come inside, young man. You know,
I do enjoy it. People come in, people ask questions. If I can answer them all.
What about the last time I was here, the chap who was the son of the guy who
died?
Go on,
died a month ago.
You're a Joshua?
He's a Joshua.
Oh, not another Joshua.
Jack
was
71.
Oh, maybe I think there's someone else.
No, no, that was him. No. You're thinking the same one. I'm 78.
No.
I'm 21.
Yeah. No, Jack was 71.
Oh.
He died about 6 weeks ago.
Better.
Jack, yeah. Terrific.
That's what I used to call him, Jackie Living.
Yeah.
So this place then goes right back to, when was it?
1899. And on Christmas 1899, we had our first wedding here.
Your first
wedding.
Oh,
yeah. On Christmas.
Funny enough, my brother got married on Boxing Day.
Yeah.
Boxing Day, but it couldn't have been because Boxing Day was a Sabbath. You can't get married on Sabbath, so they got married on the 27th. So it worked out. It worked out well.
Excuse me to Uncle Ned.
But
so what community came out? Was it like Russia?
Russian Polish, predominant. And because it was that in their homeland, Russian homeland, they would have created wooden huts.
Yeah.
With no electric light, no candle light, no gas light. So how are they going to read the scrolls of the law? By fan light, you see above it. And when this was remodeled after the war, the people who were still, their heart was still in the homeland, they said, no, we want it somewhat similar. They put the fan light here. And with all the lights switched off on the most dull day in December, you can take out one of the scrolls of the law, put it on the desk there, and still read it. Because the normal prayers, the normal running from the bed, they've done it every... It's like me when I go to the synagogue. I don't care where he is on a Saturday morning. I can find him. Mm-hmm. But they were even better than me. They not only knew it, I could tell him where he's gone wrong the week before. make sure you don't do it. Because we had this experience. We had this experience on Saturday. The Reverend was doing something. We came to a last part. And all of a sudden, I looked, because I was a warden in there, and the other warden was sitting beside me. And he said, hang on, he's just jumped two verses. He said, the Reverend then leaned across and said, did I miss out something? I said, yeah, two verses. And I go back. I said, no, just keep going. Because for the end of it, you want to go back on anything. But, you know, if you can do that, it's great. But unfortunately, you can't do that in lots of synagogues. You can't do that. I've got that feeling with them. You know, we have a way with it. An enjoyable way.
Yeah, you don't want to be too formal, do you?
No. Well, you've got to have the formality in regards the respect within the prayers and everything else. Good afternoon. Would you care to sign in, please? So you know where you are and what you're about.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you must be able to speak to people on a level. Mm. No, don't speak. Why is that? I said to my rabbi, don't speak down. Speak to. Mm. Look at the person when you're speaking to them. Don't speak to him there and you talk to people. I get so annoyed with my rabbi. So I said to him, Natalie, you're not even looking when you're speaking. You're doing something else. Your mind's not there. You know? But I can say that to you.
Listen carefully. You can hear next door singing. It's the mosque next door. Can you hear in the background? We're in a synagogue and we can hear a mosque. And incredible.
For a few minutes, whilst they call, because we can't hear.
No.
So we wait a few minutes and we carry on, no problem.
So you've got good relationships with the Muslims,
yes.
Yeah.
That I must say.
But for them, it must be weird having a tiny synagogue next to these massive mosques.
Yeah.
They must, it's just like Israel, isn't it? Israel surrounded by all these big countries, but it's still there and you're still here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, as I say, I always say they've got their arms around us.
Yeah. So in a good way.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
This should become like a museum of Jewish culture, really.
This is what we're trying to keep it as an education centre. We have the schools in.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can get some funding.
Yeah.
The new committee's trying to.
Could it ever be like recommissioned? You know, if more people moved into the area.
Yes, hopefully.
Yeah, it could still become like a proper working synagogue.
Hopefully. Now and again we have people coming.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have somebody come in from over the road. You know, somebody else came in one day.
Yeah.
Well, not for a service, but occasion like this.
Yeah.
We met them over, what's the name, Cross Harbour. We went shopping in the Asda's.
Yeah.
And of course, Nat was wearing his yarmulke. And I said, oh, it's nice to see other Jewish people. Yes, certainly. So, things like that.
Yeah.
But often we've had people say, a few times we are open, mainly Yonta.
Yeah.
Oh, I've been past him many a time.
Yeah.
Never seen inside.
No.
So sometimes we have to say, I'm sorry, there's a service coming. But if an occasion like this, or we've got the school children, you say, yes, please come inside, you know. But,
it must be confusing, especially some of the little Muslim kids coming here thinking, isn't this a Muslim place? Because everything else is Muslim around here.
They
understand the Jewish.
They're told a certain amount by the teachers.
Yeah.
You know, and we always say to them, well, what is different from here? Who goes to church? Some put up. Who goes to mosque?
Yeah.
And we say to them, what is the difference between church?
Yeah.
They say, well, you've got carpets or something like that. The Muslims say, well, we don't have any seats. you know, things like that.
Yeah.
They're mainly 7 to 10
yeah.
year olds,
yeah.
it all depends,
yeah.
you know, so I mean, they're still primary school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, we did have some boys from the academy, absolute gentlemen they were.
What academy is it?
Muslim.
Oh, Muslim?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they were absolute young
yeah.
gentlemen. I'm not kidding. The only children we don't get in are the Jewish children.
Is that
funny?
Ironic? Inside Fieldgate Street Synagogue. You've been listening to the caretaker and his wife, Nat, and his wife. What passion, what sort of warmth and positive behaviour and attitude. Incredible that, it's synagogues, just like churches, are just about the people, really. It's not the building, it's the people. And it's, well, people like this are still around, then these places won't die. But unfortunately, this place has died. There's not enough people to keep it going. And it's just opened up special days and for school parties. And it's just a shame. It's a lovely place, so much atmosphere. And being next to a mosque, it really makes a statement. Even though you probably just heard the singing from the mosque. But maybe they should keep their windows closed during these times. Okay, back again. We're now overlooking the Whitechapel Road at a very busy junction. Probably there's a lot of noise here, but Moira would be very interested to know that facing us over there is the building where the Messianic Testimony started. That tall building, yeah, which is now, says Muscan. Before that, it was a dance studio, and before that, it was the building that was built by David Baron back in the 19th century, called the Hebrew Christian Testimony, or something like that. Anyway, it later became the Messianic Testimony, which, as we know, moved to Barking, and it's now in Reading. It was built next to the big like theatre or playhouse next door, which is a gap there, and it's been a gap there for about 40 or 50 years. Used to be the Pavilion Theatre, with the Yiddish Theatre. So as they queued up for the theatre, there'll be the Jewish Christians giving out the tracts to the people in the queue. So I'm sure they were crumpled up, I'd imagine, in most cases. But so anyway, that building survived the war. It had an incendiary bomb lobbed at it, but it still survived that. And, was one of the great mission societies. Just further down, you can't see it, there is where the Salvation Army started as well, down here. The next corner was where the PDSA started, with the sick animals. Yeah, sick animals. We had the pub down one of these roads. Was that the pub down there, the Blind Beggar, where the Cray twins did their stuff. And the Crays themselves were born down this road, Valence Street, I think. Also, the last big V2 from the Second World War landed here, killed about 200 Jewish people. It's like virtually the last day of the war. It was a bomb, a V2, the big rockets, 1945, like a few weeks before the end of the war. It was the whole building was knocked out. That was commemorated a few years back, actually, like the 70th anniversary of it, or 60th anniversary. What else? We had Jack the Ripper, did his stuff down here. Elephant Man was found in one of these shops along here. Yeah. We've got the London Hospital here. Which has its own background and history. And then we've got the mosque around the corner, and probably a few other things I've forgotten. So there's so much history. This is Charles Dickens' London as well. This history was made down there. We're going to go to one more place. Nelson Street Synagogue will be our next port of call.
Built in an earlier style, and although it's all partly traditionally Eastern European, pointed out quite recently that the Eastern Wall actually resembles what was the great synagogue, Duke's Place, which was the oldest Ashkenazi synagogue, which was bombed.
So is this Ashkenazi then?
This is Ashkenazi. Yeah, it's the original name was the Nelson Street Sephardish Synagogue. The clue is in the Ish or Sephardish, which is a Yiddish word.
Yeah.
It was never Sephardi, but elements of the service follow Sephardi style. It's like, you are Jewish? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah. There are extra words in the Kaddish and slight variation in the order of service that follows Sephardi. And the way Hasidim does them, they also. So, but the pronunciation and the tunes, everything is Ashkenazi, and most of the congregation are Ashkenazi.
Right.
It confuses everybody.
Yeah. It's still people here, sort of relatives of those who were originally here.
There's me. other than that, not, I'm trying to think, no, not really.
Does your family go back then?
Three generations. Yes. And originally, it's commemorated on the plaque, my mother's family from the Belzer Synagogue, which amalgamated with in the 1930s.
Right.
From where?
The Belzer Synagogue, which was in Commercial Road. My grandfather was vice president there, and I think vice president here. And that would have been up to about 1940.
Wow.
And my late uncle was the last president of the synagogue. He died about 4 years ago. He was 95. And until he was 93, he was still sitting in the box making the announcements and so on. So I got a long family history.
Yeah, it's just as we're sort of gathering from all the other synagogues, it's the new generation are not coming through.
They're not. We all hope with the redevelopment of Docklands, there's an infrastructure waiting to be revived. It just hasn't happened. I know it sounds terrible. If you read the website of the Congregation of Jacob, where it's flourishing and everyone's flocking back, it's all absolute nonsense.
Really?
It really is. It's spin, you know. We're all in exactly the same position. We all struggle for a million, and, you know.
Is that because the young people are just saying they don't believe anymore?
It's two things. One, I mean, obviously there are some young people who have come back and who just don't go to a shul. They're just not interested. But the other thing is also, I think, for non-Jewish people, the Docklands redevelopment is wonderful. But young Jews know their parents or their grandparents did all they could to get away from the East End. So there's a stigma about coming back. You know, you don't have Jewish people flocking
back.
It could
be a stigma, but also the sense of nostalgia and a sense of going back to your roots.
Yeah, but that's on that's like today, that's people coming on visits. We get that. But not when it comes to actually live around here. It's far less.
You get some that are moving back to, say, you know, the Brick Lane area, you know, the trendy area.
That's a trendy area, Spitalfields around there, yes.
Do you think if any of those were Jewish and wanted to rediscover their roots, maybe?
Yeah, but then, I mean, you know, in that area, there's Sanders Road, Shul, which is open once a fortnight.
Yeah.
So, you know, clearly they're not flocking back to
How often are you open?
We've opened every Shabbos, every Saturday morning, and all the Yom Tovim.
So you get a minion every Saturday then?
Yes, but we do breathe a sigh of relief once the 10th one arrives. You know. It's difficult, but you know, sometimes we have to hang on and wait and wait.
Yeah.
Other times, you know, we get 14, 15, but it's not, you know, none of the shuls are flourishing.
Did you get people coming from when Philgate Street closed down then?
Well, we have one regular from there, and when they're open once a month, so we have to wait longer sometimes for the minion, because he's a former warden from there, he goes there, of course, so it affects us. And the same Sanders Row is open once a fortnight. The minister from there is also Federation Minister for the East, and most weeks when they're not open, they'll come here. And even when they are open, we tend to start and finish late, he often comes on to here in time for the Kiddush, and very rarely if we're still waiting for one, so he'll make up the minion, at least people can say Kaddish, who needs to, and so on. It's a shame on our rabbi who walks from Stanford Hill and back, an hour and a half walk.
An hour and a half walk.
Wow.
Yeah, and then to sit and wait for a minion, it's a terrible thing.
Must be a very fit rabbi then.
Well, he's above it, so, you know, he's
dedicated.
He must be fit, he's got nine children, look at Baba.